KALW.
So I know in my heart of the value of that space and what community can do for someone who is lost.
People's Park closed in January so that UC Berkeley could build a student dorm.
Nobody should become so disenchanted or so gloomy that they give up even before the final battle.
Is this the end of the park or just another chapter in its story? Then, how the departure of Oakland's last Major League Baseball team has prompted a lot of finger-pointing.
If you don't have teamwork, leadership, and trust dealing with difficult circumstances or building anything positive, you've got a real problem.
It's the next episode of Foul Ball. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Berkeley's People's Park is among the most contentious pieces of land in the Bay Area. It helped put Berkeley on the map as a bastion of progressive idealism in the 1960s. It built on the heels of the free speech movement, the Vietnam War protests, and the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. And now it's listed on the National Park Service's National Register of Historic Places. But UC Berkeley owns those 2.8 acres, and for all this time, it's wanted to build housing for students there. This Sunday marks 55 years since hundreds of volunteers transformed a vacant lot into People's Park. But this year's anniversary marks an uncertain time in its storied history. In January, the university closed the park so they could start building the dorm, but a court case and a very committed group of protectors are preventing Cal from breaking ground. This begs the question, is this the end of the park? Or just another chapter in its story? KLW's Alistair Boone takes us to the park to learn more.
It's nearly 1 a.m. on January 4th, and I'm trying to get into People's Park. UC Berkeley Public Information Officer Dan Mogiloff has corralled members of the media onto a corner a couple of blocks away, as if we're about to enter a combat zone.
You guys want to come around? Please stay with me for right now, okay? I'll walk you up to the park.
Inside the park, hundreds of UC police officers are facing off with a group of about 50 protesters. Some of them have been camped out there for days after getting word that the university might bring in law enforcement.
Guys, we'll be back, but obviously nobody comes in unless they get escorted by me or somebody from my office.
Their goal is to resist UC Berkeley's most recent push to build student housing there. The university has plans to build a dorm on the park, 60 feet tall with 1,100 beds. They also say they're going to build low-income housing on the site, but those plans are in limbo after the developer pulled out last spring. This project has long been thwarted by the park's protectors, but tonight, the university is not messing around. It shelled out about $8 million on the operation unfolding around me, including about $4 million on law enforcement.
United will never be defeated. The people!
When I finally get in, the park's defenders are intensely outnumbered by police. It's 46 degrees outside, and arborists have begun cutting down the trees that line the park's perimeter to make way for a giant barricade, a fence made out of shipping containers, 17 feet high and topped with razor wire and surveillance cameras. It's the same type of wall that makes up sections of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Officer Hernandez, Elmer.
Police arrest protesters seemingly at random, picking them off from the crowd one by one.
Where am I going? Where am I going? Where am I going? Where are you taking this young man?
Why? Doria.
Eventually, they leave and regroup on Telegraph Avenue, where a rally has begun.
Move over to this side and you'll be able to exit safely.
I don't think we've lost anything at our core.
I catch up with Lisa Teague outside the park on Telegraph. Lisa is a People's Park advocate and harm reductionist. They've been out there nearly every day for 13 years, passing out food and supplies like Narcan or hanging out. They started spending time at the park in 2011 after they won the housing lottery and moved off the street into a nearby apartment. I asked them how they're doing now that the park has been closed, potentially for good.
Tired and angry, I guess, and you know, faced with such overwhelming odds, it's really not, it's not a great feeling. But I'm really happy about the fact that we have some good numbers here at this rally, and that people seem to be prepared to keep on struggling. And, you know, that is our thing, you know.
That people are prepared to keep on struggling. This, more than anything else, defines the history of People's Park. The fight over this land and the dorm that UC officials are trying to build right now began 55 years ago.
People's Park erupted in 1969, the brainchild of several people who were at loose ends and who found themselves drinking cappuccino at the Café Med, the Café Mediterranean.
That's Steve Wasserman, publisher of Heyday Books. He had a front row seat to the birth of the park back then, as student body president at nearby Berkeley High School. The university had just used eminent domain to demolish attractive homes so that they could build a dorm.
But in the event, the university never did. They just let the lot lie fallow. And so, in the great spirit of provocation, these troublemakers and mischief makers decided to, why don't we, you know, just, the land belongs to those who use it. So why don't we turn this into a garden?
These mischief makers pooled their money and went to the hardware store. They bought sod, seeds, and gardening supplies and put a notice in the Berkeley Barb, a weekly underground newspaper.
Hear ye, hear ye. A park will be built this Sunday between Dwight and Haste.
Soon, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people were coming every day, whole families, my family among them, to build, to plant, to make gardens. And every day, people would gather over a large open fire pit and cook a big stew, and everybody was somehow equal in this enterprise.
That's how the park was planted. It went on this way for weeks, a diverse crowd of people of all ages, gardening and hanging out together.
And it was a great thing until the day it wasn't.
Policeman just shot somebody with a shotgun. They've got shotguns now, and they're using them on people. Somebody was just shot with birdshot.
May 15th, 1969 is referred to as Bloody Thursday. The university put up a fence around the park in the early hours of the morning, and 5,000 students faced off against the police there. They were met with tear gas and, ultimately, live rounds. One protester was killed, and another one was permanently blinded. This kicked off even more protest. Tens of thousands of people would march for the park, and 2 years later, they tore the fence down. In the decades since, there have been free stores, concerts, meals, and gardening days. From time to time, the university has tried to build on the park, but it is always met with resistance.
What accounts for the monomaniacal attachment, the near obsession by the university's overseers to block this piece of property?
This is a question that many people have asked. The university has identified 15 other sites where they could build or expand dorms near campus. But Cal says their plans to build on the park are simply a response to the dire lack of student housing. And it's true. It offers the lowest percentage of housing in the whole UC system and increases student enrollment nearly every year. The university also says the park isn't living up to its founding ideals and complains about crime and homelessness there. But Lisa Teague and others who defend the park disagree.
It's just fulfilling what the park is there for, because people are in need. People are in need of a space to exist without constant scrutiny, without fear of being told to move along because you've been there for an hour.
They say the park plays a central role in supporting people with nowhere else to go, in the same way that it's provided space for people to organize around the most pressing social movements of the past. For many people, like Lisa, this support has been impossible to find anywhere else.
I can personally feel the value. I was housed near the park in 2011, and 13 years later, I have a community. I have a focus. I have a purpose. So I know in my heart of the value of that space and what community can do for someone who is lost or in need.
The more time you spend at the park, the more stories like this you hear. A Vietnam veteran who needed a place to begin grieving and forgiving himself, or a homeless kid who found life-saving resources there. But the dream of a truly public commons may be no match for UC Berkeley.
All rise.
The university hasn't been able to break ground on the dorm project because of a lawsuit that was filed by the park's protectors in 2021. That case is finally playing out in the state Supreme Court right now, and the park's lawyer had to concede that the lawsuit alone couldn't stop the project.
Even under your analysis, Mr. Lippe, you concede that the People's Park project is going to be built. Is that correct?
This case provides no platform to stop that. I would concede that. Whether they actually build it or not, that's up to UC at this point and any other efforts that might be made by the community.
Thank you very much to both counsel. We appreciate your arguments. The matter is submitted.
I'm pretty pessimistic. I think the university is likely to win this battle.
That's Steve Wasserman again. He's referring to the sheer number of resources the university is working with. It's budgeted $400 million to build the dorm on People's Park, including $50 million in contingency funds. That means money to cover the cost of litigation, delays, and special considerations related to clearing the site. By all measures, the idea of saving the park seems almost insane.
But long experience teaches me that one should live one's life as if the glass is half full, even while suspecting it's half empty. So I wouldn't underestimate the degree to which our subjective consciousness can actually change history. And nobody should become so disenchanted or so gloomy that they give up even before the final battle.
I believe
that we
will win.
At a recent rally, a small group of about 20 people were gathered a few blocks away from the park. Lisa was there, too.
Sounds a little like woo-woo, but when you step on the park, it's like you feel the struggle and the love and the sweat and the blood that went into keeping it a park against all odds. Land reclaimed from one of the most powerful educational institutions in this country. 55 years.
I believe that we will win!
I believe that we will win!
Who decides history? There's a redwood tree at People's Park that towers above the wall of shipping containers surrounding it. Looking up, I'm reminded. It's an open question.
Let it be so! Let it be! Yes!
Let it be so!
In Berkeley, I'm Alistair Boone for Cross Currents.
Alistair is a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy, our tuition-free audio storytelling program for adults. Applications are open right now, but not for long. The deadline to apply is this Sunday, April 21st. And there'll be a block party this weekend to celebrate the 55th anniversary of People's Park that's on Telegraph Avenue between Haste and Dwight. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for allowing use of their archives for this story. We'll have a link to their historical collection at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Last week, the Oakland Athletics announced they're moving to a minor league park in Sacramento for the next three seasons. Next, we'll take you inside baseball with the next episode of our new series, Foul Ball. Here's host Sunny Khalid.
I'm Sunny Khalid, KALW's news editor, and welcome to Foul Ball, a season-long series looking at what is the A's final season in Oakland, which will also mark the end of Major League team sports in a city that boasted all four a half century ago. So sit back, relax, and listen to a dirge of what is and what once was. A week ago, John Fisher stood in the 10,000-seat Sutter Hill Stadium in West Sacramento, ending speculation about where the A's would be playing next season. The team owner announced that his ball club would be playing there until a billion-dollar dome stadium could be built on the Las Vegas Strip in 2028.
We're excited to be here for the next 3 years, playing in this beautiful ballpark, but also being able to watch some of the greatest players in baseball, whether they be athletics players or Aaron Judge and others, launch home runs out of this very intimate, the most intimate ballpark in all of Major League Baseball.
But news of a Major League team playing in a minor league park, the home of the Giants minor league team, for the next three seasons drew widespread and immediate ridicule. And not just from Oakland. Among the critics was longtime sportscaster Rich Eisen, who blasted Fisher's decision on his national podcast.
They call baseball the show for a reason, because it's not the minor leagues. It's Major League Baseball, and you don't play Major League Baseball in minor league facilities. And if you do, you don't brag about it.
Meanwhile, on the field, Fisher's team, with again the lowest payroll in the major leagues, went on a bit of a roll, splitting the next 10 games, but winning three series for the first time since 2021. But there were even fewer fans to cheer them on. Through the first 10 home games at the Coliseum, the A's drew an average of just 6,200 fans, by far the worst in the majors. Their Saturday afternoon game against Washington drew just 3,300 fans, the lowest crowd of the season in the majors. With little talent on the field and even less hope in the empty stands, it appears the A's last season in Oakland is destined to end with a sigh as opposed to a whimper or even a bang. In the last episode, I spoke with Dave Newhouse, the co-author of Goodbye Oakland, about the A's last stand in Oaktown. Recently, I sat down with his co-author, Andy Dolich, a longtime sports executive with the A's, Warriors, and 49ers, to talk about the death knell of big league sports in the East Bay. We're dealing in the aftermath of the shocking announcement that the A's are actually going to go to Sacramento. Is there a villain here?
There are three major points of villainy. Number one, John Fisher, owner of the Oakland A's. Number two, Major League Baseball, Commissioner Rob Manfred. Number three, elected officials in the city of Oakland and Alameda County, various responsibilities over time. Those three entities, in my view, have shown a complete lack of teamwork, leadership, and trust. And in any business, no matter what it is, if you don't have teamwork, leadership, and trust dealing with difficult circumstances or building anything positive, you've got a real problem. And they haven't ever had it. This is another example of it. And there are still so many moving pieces, unanswered questions in the A's future that this is going to go on for a while before there's any kind of certainty. And my certainty would be, all right, you're playing a game in a new multi-billion dollar facility in Las Vegas, Nevada, in 2028 or beyond.
There was some optimism when it was announced that the city of Oakland and the A's were going to meet. They had their meeting, And then 2 days later, bam, the announcement. What was your reaction? Was this a fait accompli? Do you think that John Fisher had already decided that they were going to go? This was a last ditch attempt by the city to save face. Do you look at this cynically, or do you think there was actually something that may have been, an agreement may have come from that meeting?
I'm a Brooklyn, New York born, cynical, sarcastic, Long Island raised person. So I'll always go, wait a second, what did they just say? This was the third meeting in a period of several weeks between representatives of the city, Oakland, and the A's. Alameda County, another player in all this, was not necessarily up to speed on what the mayor, Sheng Tao, was offering. And when Sheng Tao went public that, okay, my original request to Major League Baseball is that we want an expansion franchise, and we also want you, John Fisher, to return half of the Coliseum property that you purchased from the county for $85 million several years ago. The A's didn't really answer that. In this latest meeting, the city laid out, oh, A's, you're paying about $1.2 million a year in rent, current. We have a mathematical economic equation that if you stay here for three more years, extend the lease, waiting for 2028, or if you're not ready to go to Vegas and it's two more years, we want you, the A's, to pay us $97 million. So I think $97 million is larger than $1.2 million a year. And we want you to give back your 50%, sell it back to the county. That's when the A's said, sorry, no, we're very, very far apart. And then the next day, literally, they announced the move to Sacramento. Without even being a cynic, you didn't have that press conference in Sacramento a day after the last Oakland conversation ended without having multiple conversations with Sacramento weeks, if not months before. So the word duplicity, I think, comes to the fore here. They were negotiating with Sacramento for a long time. They had talked to several other locations, but Sacramento, from a logic standpoint, makes some sense. Staying in Oakland has its problems, but maybe would have made the most sense, but that's off the table now.
You're a Brooklander. You were old enough to go to Ebbets Field, and people have always talked about the similarities between Oakland and San Francisco and Brooklyn and Manhattan. Do you see the same parallels, and do you see the same sort of sadness?
I've got a lot of memorabilia in and around my office here, and I'm looking at it right now, is a pen and ink drawing of Ebbets Field, Brooklyn, New York. First sporting event on the pro side that I ever went to as a five-year-old. My father, not a big sports fan, took me and my two older brothers because he got tickets from a customer. And, you know, to your point about Brooklyn and Oakland, gritty places. And I say that with the most positive overview. It's not Park Avenue. It's not Rodeo Drive. It's not California Street. You got to be tough. You got to hang in. And so the parallels to Brooklyn, Oakland, I think are significant. And different day, age, time. But when Walter O'Malley's, the Dodgers and the Giants moved west, many people were crying. But L.A. and San Francisco, a little bit different than Las Vegas. But at that time in baseball, the furthest team west was the St. Louis Cardinals. And so the move to the West Coast, that made baseball the national pastime. In this circumstance, a lot of people don't know Oakland like they don't know Brooklyn. And they just take it, well, look at these. Nobody's going to the games. The team loses 100 games. Well, I also am very proud of being involved with a team that drew close to 3 million, that went to three consecutive World Series, 88, 89, and 90. There are some parallels, and the parallel is based upon the color green, the color of the fluid that flows through the veins of professional sports ownership and many other businesses. It's green money. And essentially, John Fisher, if we think about it, he bought this team 15 years ago, now it's 60, for $180 million. He has not had success, few good years, but in the last few, worst team in baseball, worst attendance. The team's value today is $1.2 billion. And sports economists, I'm sure you've had some on your show, believe that if there is a construction project underway in Las Vegas, $2.4 billion. He doesn't care about the 80 million people that have come through the turnstiles at the Oakland Coliseum since 1968 to see this team, to see some of the greatest players in the game, multiple Hall of Famers, four world championships. And it is something that's been revamped by Major League Baseball. They want this to happen. But what people understand is that the umbilical cord with Oakland has been cut. This is a major American city that now has lost three, the California Golden Seals, let's put there, and others, and the A's, and the Warriors, and the Raiders. In my view, never to see those leagues come back into Oakland during my time left on planet Earth.
That was Andy Dolich, former sports executive and co-author of the book Goodbye Oakland, Winning, Wanderlust, and a Sport Town's Fight for Survival. He spoke with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid, and we'll be dropping episodes of Foul Ball every other week. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.